Britain's Industrial Revolution spanned a whole century. America's took only 30 years. Powered by railroads and mass production, harnessed by business mergers, and lubricated by the sweat and blood of the new immigrants. Economy and society changed faster than ever before in US history, but the country's institutions failed to adapt. In continental Europe, even in liberal Britain, a strong national government had promoted industrialization. It then gradually conceded democracy to an increasingly restless proletariat. In America, by contrast, democracy came first, and the national government remained weak because the founding fathers, authors of the US Constitution, were afraid of repeating what they saw as British tyranny. But by 1900, the Industrial Revolution had generated huge economic and social forces, such as big business, urban slums, and labour conflict, forces that government simply could not control. America's essentially 18th century institutions had to be updated to face 20th century needs. That was the goal of many pundits and reformers around 1900, loosely known as progressives. Their prime target was the inner city political machines, the most notorious of which was Tammany Hall in Manhattan. Its philosophy was expounded by George Washington Plunkett, an Irish-American who rose from butcher's boy to ward boss and eventually state senator.
If a family is burnt out, I don't ask whether they are Republicans or Democrats, and I don't refer them to the Charity Organization Society, which would investigate their case in a month or two and decide they were worthy of help about the time they are dead from starvation. I just get quarters for them, buy clothes for them, and fix them up till they get things running again. It's philanthropy. But it's politics, too. Mighty good politics.
Plunkett's motto was,
I seen my opportunities and I took them.
Essentially, he was buying votes. For Plunkett, politics wasn't about ideas.
Politics is as much a regular business as the grocery or dry goods business.
So-called muckraking journalists like Lincoln Steffens agreed with Plunkett that in America, politics was business. But for Steffens, that might be good news. Because in business, of course, the customer is always right.
There is hope, not alone despair, in the commercialism of our politics. If our political leaders are to be always a lot of political merchants, they will supply any demand we may create. All we have to do is establish a steady demand for good government.
And that's what progressives tried to do, organizing campaigns to clean up city corruption. The political machines were often in cahoots with the utility companies, which provided gas, light and streetcars at high prices and low standards. So reformers battled to establish regulatory commissions, which would police the operations of the utilities. In some smaller cities, they completely updated America's antiquated system of urban government, built around a mayor and elected council. After Galveston, Texas, was overwhelmed by a tidal wave in 1901, city government was placed in the hands of commissioners. More than 400 other cities followed suit, appointing commissioners or even professional city managers. But reforming the cities was not enough, because many of industrial America's problems ran far wider. The power of the railroads was a case in point. In The Octopus, a celebrated novel about the clash between the Southern Pacific Railroad and the wheat farmers of California, author Frank Norris used a rail map of the state as a metaphor for its politics.
The whole map was gridironed by a vast, complicated network of red lines. These centralized at San Francisco and spread north, east, and south to every quarter of the state, laying hold upon some forgotten village or town, involving it in one of a myriad branching coils, one of a hundred tentacles, drawing it, as it were, toward that center from which all this system sprang.
The octopus was an apt image, because the Southern Pacific had California in its grip. bribing local politicians and making sure its spokesman represented the state in Congress. The railroad tycoons established themselves in splendour on Nob Hill, the fashionable centre of San Francisco, men such as Leland Stanford and Charles Crocker. Crocker's mansion had a tower on the top, with a superb view over the bay. To spite his neighbour, an undertaker who refused to sell up, Crocker had a 40-foot-high fence built around three sides of the man's property. This spite fence became a symbol of all that was hated about California's railroad tycoons. But eventually, the octopus met its match, or at least lost some of its grip. A coalition of reformist Republicans campaigned in 1910 on an anti-corruption ticket. They were led by Hiram Johnson, a fiery lawyer who kept blasting the alliance of business and crime.
Your big banker, your big merchant, sinning respectability, joining hands with the criminal and the thug.
Johnson and his reformers won control of the California State House in 1910, passing the first serious law to regulate the Southern Pacific. And they went even further, stripping away the right of the state legislature to choose California's two U.S. senators in Washington, men who were staunch supporters of the Southern Pacific interest because the railroad funded most of the politicians' campaigns. Leaving the choice of U.S. senators to each state legislature had been a feature of the Constitution of 1789, because the founders wanted to guard against too much democracy. But by the 20th century, this seemed like a dangerous anachronism. In 1906, journalist David Graham Phillips wrote a series of sensational articles entitled The Treason of the Senate.
Treason is a strong word, but not too strong, rather too weak to characterize the situation in which the Senate is the eager, resourceful, indefatigable agent of interests as hostile to the American people as any invading army could be, and vastly more dangerous. Interests that manipulate the prosperity produced by all, so that it heaps up riches for the few. Interests whose growth and power can only mean the degradation of the people, of the educated into sycophants, of the masses toward serfdom. A man cannot serve two masters. The senators are not elected by the people. They are elected by the interests.
Direct election of U.S. senators by the people was one of the great campaigns of the progressive era. It swept across the states, starting in the West, and was eventually adopted in 1913 as the 17th Amendment to the Constitution. More democracy seemed to be the remedy for the corrupt interest group politics of states like California, and it was in the same spirit that progressives initiated primary elections to prevent candidates being nominated by the party bosses and their financial backers. Yet it would be wrong to depict progressivism as simply a battle of the idealists against big business. One of the slogans of the times was efficiency. To us, a rather grey word, but in the 1900s, it really got the blood going. The 19th century had seen the appliance of science to the natural order, harnessing coal, steam and oil for industrial development. Now in the 20th century, reformers argued, science should be applied to human affairs, to put society and politics on a rational footing. That would be real progress. Major businesses were in the vanguard of this kind of reform. Metropolitan Life, the giant of the insurance industry, with an appropriately huge skyscraper in Lower Manhattan, pioneered schemes at a nickel or dime a week for workers and their families. Young policyholders aged 6 to 18 were encouraged to join Metropolitan's Health and Happiness League. As bait for essay prizes and field trips, the children had to sign a pledge.
I promise. I will wash my hands and face before every meal, and my mouth and teeth each morning and evening. As spitting is unclean and helps spread consumption and other diseases, I will not spit upon the public streets or in public places. I will not use a public drinking cup. I will use only paper ones or carry my own cup. I will destroy every housefly I possibly can.
And so on. All very progressive, but also good business, because healthy policyholders would keep on paying their nickels and dimes for longer and would need fewer dollars in return from metropolitan life. So business supported some progressive reforms, but opposed or ignored others, such as direct election of senators or social welfare legislation. But those measures were backed by the urban political machines, often regarded by middle-class progressives as their main opponents. Here is one appalling example. The Triangle Shirtwaist Factory was just a few blocks from Metropolitan's skyscraper, but the two businesses couldn't have been more different. The factory occupied the top three floors of a 10-storey building, where young immigrants, mostly women, worked 72 hours a week for $6 or $7. Flammable materials were everywhere, lighting was by gas lamps, and smoking was widespread. No one knows how the fire started on Saturday, March the 25th, 1911. But one door had been locked by the bosses to prevent theft, and the rickety fire escape soon collapsed. According to the New York Times,
"The building was fireproof. In fact, after the flames had done their worst last night, the building hardly showed a sign. Only the stock within it and the girl employees were burned. Some of them escaped by running down the stairs, but in a moment or two, this avenue was cut off by flame. The girls rushed to the windows and looked down at Green Street 100 feet below them. The crowd yelled, 'Don't jump!' But it was jump or be burned. The proof of which is found in the fact that 50 burned bodies were taken from the ninth floor alone. They jumped. They crashed through broken glass. They crushed themselves to death on the sidewalk."
The Triangle Shirtwaist Inferno was Manhattan's worst fire until 9/11. 148 people died. But some good did come out of the tragedy. Pressed by the Women's Garment Union, the state of New York set up an investigatory commission, whose recommendations resulted in 56 new welfare laws. These were shepherded through the state legislature by the Tammany Hall leaders, successors to George Washington Plunkett. While the machine politicians opposed some progressive courses, such as city managers and commissions, which undercut their power, they were in the vanguard of legislation to promote health and safety and workers' insurance. In other words, progressivism was a broad church. The demand for reform embraced middle-class Yankees and immigrant workers. It included utopian idealists and pragmatic businessmen. Each group had an agenda that reflected its interests. The unifying theme was a shared awareness that the old laissez-faire methods were no longer sufficient in the industrial age. Government had to take more of a role in American life. And that didn't just mean the cities and the states. The really big problems, such as the railroads or banking, were national in scope. They required action by the federal government, by Congress, and above all, by the president.